This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show talking about a brand new book. It's called The Problem of Democracy, The President's Atoms Confront the Cult of Personality. And we're going to talk with the authors, both of whom teach history at Louisiana State University. Nancy Eisenberg, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
And Andrew Burstein, thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with you, Nancy, and of course, jump in, Andrew, as you see fit. Why did you write the book?
Well, we have co-authored a dual biography before this. We wrote a book called Madison and Jefferson. And in a way, this is it's not the sequel, but it is kind of redressing what we came across by looking at the what would become the Republican Democratic Party and looking at from the other side, looking at the side of John Adams, who was associated with the Federalist Party, and then his son would end up leaving the Federalist Party and actually working with Madison and James Monroe. But we thought that this would be an important study because never before has anyone really analyzed the relationship between the father and son. There have been biographies of John Adams or biographies of John Quincy Adams, and we thought that this would be the perfect way to not just do a personal study, which our book is, but also to look at how politics changed over time, going from the early Republic to the early antebellum period.
Well, Andrew, you have a provocative title, The Problem of Democracy. Describe that for our listeners.
As Americans, we think we've inherited a valid definition of democracy, but we really haven't. The founders didn't give us a definition for the ages. In fact, they doubted the popular wisdom when they confined voting rights privileges to property holders. And no one so much as John Adams, I would say, was the first to really worry about the power of celebrity and undermining any chance of democracy succeeding. There's an irony embedded in this because his son, John Quincy, and just as the Bushes refer to themselves as 41 and 43, we call them 2 and 6
yes.
when we talk. John Quincy was the first U.S. president in an inaugural address to label the United States a representative democracy. So the idea of democracy wasn't born with the Constitution, and in fact, the framers of the Constitution didn't perceive of the United States as a democracy. They perceived of us as a republic, and the word democracy had a negative connotation for a number of years, and it wasn't until the early 19th century that democracy stopped being associated with mobocracy, with anarchy, and became a positive feature of the U.S. system. What makes the Adamses special in addressing the problem of democracy? For us, they were barometers in measuring the pressure on government, and it applies to us now as well as back then, that laws should be instituted that were fair to a majority of the citizens. And democracy only succeeded if political leaders had the moral courage not to pander for votes, that provided moral clarity coming from government. And, you know, we don't remember the Adamses for their ideas, but their ideas are very much alive and part of the political discourse of the present moment.
Well, Nancy, right in the front of the book, you've got a quote from John Adams that is, quote, "There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." Elaborate on that.
Yes. This is the other thing we love about them, is that they relied heavily on history. So they went back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. They loved Cicero. And they realized that all governments could fail. And this is a reality check that we need to understand. Democracies don't operate as a machine on their own. They need to be protected, whether it's by institutions, which is another one of John Adams' frames, we're a government of laws, not men, and that they were also deeply interested in the dangers of human psychology, that no one was immune to the temptation of fame, and this is where they identified the danger of the cult of celebrity. And they realized that voters are spectators and that all politics is theater. And that what was happening, even in the government as they watched it, was that many politicians and parties, which the Constitution never anticipated, were using the same techniques as the old world aristocracy, birth, riches, and beauty. They were marketing candidates for their appearance, prominent name, glamorous reputation. And the problem with this is that it means that voters are often not paying attention to the policies, but they're living vicariously through idols. And this is the danger that he saw and how it could undermine a democracy.
He was saying, when he referred to suicide, you know, there never was a democracy that did not commit suicide, he perceived that the envy among the people in a democracy would lead to there being the envied few on top who've gotten to the top as a moneyed aristocracy within the democracy, and that this aristocracy or moneyed oligarchy would produce popular upheaval, because that's what had happened from the ancient times, and America was the first modern republic. So the more it democratized, the more he saw the possibility, especially in the time of the French Revolution, that democracy could, in fact, implode, commit suicide.
Well, let's talk about the Adams father and son here. They're both members of the elite of this brand new country, as the people who were around them, Washington and Jefferson and Madison and all these others were. What was their public persona? How were they viewed so that they would be unlike somebody who would, you know, favor a cult of personality, for example?
Well, one of the things it's interesting that you say that, because John Adams came from a much more humbler background than Washington or Jefferson. We have to realize that it was the Virginians who really fashioned themselves as aristocrats. They had the most wealth, and they imitated the fashions and styles of the British aristocracy. And even John Quincy Adams, even though he grows up traveling in Europe and, in a sense, has his father's name, and he was very deeply worried that he didn't want to be rewarded for nepotism, still, they never acquired a great deal of wealth. They never acquired what we measure as the elite standards. They were elites in terms of their political background and their election to political office.
And they were notable in terms of the actions they took. John Adams defended the British soldiers at the Boston Massacre, and John Quincy Adams was famous for the Armistead slave ship case 40 or 50 years later. They were singular in terms of their getting a lot of attention for something that they did. But what was their public persona? How were they viewed? Washington is sort of the guy who would not be king, taller than the average American at the time. Jefferson had this larger-than-life persona, I guess. I mean, we still think of him that way in almost religious aspects. Who were the Adams people to the voter?
Well, it's interesting that you mention Washington, because actually Washington's presidency borrowed the trappings of royalty. I mean, he lived in a grand mansion. He rode in a lavishly equipped carriage. Like British monarchs, his birthday became a national holiday. And Hamilton, who was his party, campaign manager, exploited this. I mean, his image was known to all. And even John Adams noted that Washington's most important trait was his handsome face and his tall stature, his elegant form, his graceful movements. This was one of the dangers at the Constitutional Convention, the fear of having an elected monarch. Washington, in a sense, does reflect the cult of celebrity in the same way that that cult of celebrity is refashioned and remade for Jefferson and then for Andrew Jackson.
What makes the two Adamses, their political profile, their public persona, was as nonconformists and two who would not identify with the party ideology, the party loyalty. They were individuals who felt that the moral courage demonstrated by an individual who was capable of changing his mind, not just doing as the party ordered, but to go solving problems by problems for the benefit of the majority of the people. And the fact that they didn't align even with the party that technically they belonged to, they never tried to become the head of the party as we think of the president as the leader of his political party these days. They maintained their nonconformity, their iconoclasm, and and focused attention on government institutions, that they should function undramatically based on rational processes. And they feared that government could become unbalanced if one single narrow ideology dictated by the party directed the course of events. And so one of the reasons why they're not heralded in our time is not just because they were short and stubby. They didn't acquire that kind of dramatic persona that we associate with the campaigning charisma. Jefferson's writings were distributed in such a way that his beautiful speech and his tremendous optimism about the future of the country, his sound bites stay with us because they're the way America perceives itself on its best day. And he's the father of American exceptionalism. Neither of the Adamses ushered in the age of anything. But that doesn't mean that even though they were defeated the polls after a single term in office, it doesn't mean that they bore faulty ideas. It doesn't mean that they don't speak to us today. And I think, you know, at bottom, that's why we wrote this book, because their political identities have suffered in history, but also they wrote so much that it's kind of hard to get to wrap your head around it. And so we've tried to go through the decades of correspondence between them, the decades of diaries that they wrote, and cull from that the essence of the politician, the essence of the political thinker, and the criticism that they delivered that was unsuccessful at the time, but was not wrong.
We're talking with Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, the authors of The Problem of Democracy, The President's Adams Confront the Cult of Personality, and we'll be back with them in just a moment.
Minnesota State University Moorhead's Performing Arts Series presents the James Sewell Ballet in the regional premiere of Titticut Follies, a riveting production based on filmmaker Frederick Wiseman's landmark documentary. Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. on the Hansen Theater stage on the MSUM campus. Details at mnstate.edu/perform.
And we'll be talking with choreographer James Sewell and documentarian Frederick Wiseman later in our show today, but right now we're talking with Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein, the authors of The Problem of Democracy, The President's Adams Confront the Cult of Personality. Nancy, just describe for us, for our listeners and for me, what a presidential election would have been like in the John Adams era.
Well, one of the things we highlight is even in the very first election, the election of 1789, when Washington was elected and each presidential elector had to cast two votes. There was corruption that seeped in even at that moment. Essentially, Alexander Hamilton spread rumors among Southerners that New Englanders might try to steal the election because he wanted to make sure that John Adams got, you know, half the number of votes that Washington did. Basically, there could be only one surrogate king, one idealized star. And then if we go to the election of 1800, it was raucous. There were vicious attacks. And again, Hamilton literally tried to undermine John Adams getting elected. So if we think that today's elections are problematic, the 1790s, the 1800s suffered from similar difficulties. The role of newspapers. Newspapers could say anything. There wasn't even the two-source rule today. So we have to really appreciate that the nature of politics, the nature of the beast, was not as idealized as we want to imagine the past to be.
Andrew, had the process of electing a president frayed even further by the time John Q. was running for election?
Oh, yes. There were several viable candidates that year, and it was thrown into the House of Representatives in one of the most topsy-turvy presidential campaigns in American history. Andrew Jackson actually received more electoral votes than John Quincy Adams did. John Quincy, by the way, had been Secretary of State for 8 years under President Monroe, and he was Monroe's favorite candidate, even though Monroe was a Virginian and he was a New Englander. And Andrew Jackson kind of appeared from the wings. He wasn't part of the campaign initially, but his war hero stature and the campaign biography that he was the first celebrated American presidential candidate to have a full-length biography, campaign biography written. So he came from the outside, if it were a horse race, and we do have an illustration as such in the book, and nosed out JQA because of the four significant candidates. None received a majority of the votes. It was thrown into the House. And because of some backroom shenanigans, you might say, or arm twisting, Speaker of the House Henry Clay gave John Quincy Adams the votes of Kentucky, his home state, Clay's home state, and some others. And that's how John Quincy eked out the presidency. And the apparent corruption, although John Quincy wasn't personally associated with it, but the apparent corruption in the fact that he named Henry Clay Secretary of State just a few days after his election made it look a little difficult, and his presidency was hampered by the appearance of corruption for the next 4 years.
Nancy, in the book that you wrote with Andrew, you kind of distill the Adams father and son philosophy about political parties into three major categories. And number one is factions. They ultimately serve private interests. Number two, they exploited the cult of celebrity. Number three, they stuck on the Washington image that we've referred to earlier. Let's delve into number one there. As factions, they ultimately serve private interests. Is this how money gets into politics early on in the American experience?
Well, it's much more about money today. I mean, this is one of the things that even Jefferson and Adams agreed in. They didn't believe that money should be allowed to shape the outcome of elections, and that's really more of a modern phenomenon, how much money plays in elections. But one of the things that they did attack was the rise of political parties. As I said, the Constitution never anticipated political parties. Parties serve the interest of parties. And that's one of the problems. They're not about serving the public good. And this is part of John Adams' critique, is that what happens is that voters may think that they're voting their self-interest and that they're participating in democratic elections. But often what he feared is that an oligarchy or that political factions would really be pulling the strings behind the scenes. And that becomes even more apparent by the time you get to Andrew Jackson, where the parties are embraced. They are like quasi-military machines. They believe in party drilling. They believe in paying off party supporters with the spoils of office, basically bribing them to support the party. And the danger there is that people become more attached to the party than they do to even thinking about what do the candidates represent.
There's a reason why the founding generation did not refer to the group that they belonged to as a party,
mm-hmm.
because party meant faction. And to them, what we would call special interests, and they rather referred to them as the Federalist interest or the Republican interest, because an interest was less fixed, whereas a party was associated with a corruptible faction.
It just seems that the role of a president, when all is said and done, when the election is over, is to be the uniter of the country. So if you've got a president who's the head of a party, that sort of fragments that unity a little bit. And I'm sure you didn't write this book in a vacuum. It is now 2019, and we're in the midst of a presidency that seems to be factionally based.
Yes. I mean, as historians, we have to spend lots of years doing research. So we started working on this book before 2016. But I think part of what is relevant and part of what we want people who read this book to understand is this idea that democracy and its dangers have a longer history. Because we often throw up our hands and think, oh, we have a problem today. This is a brand new problem. And in fact, if you go into the past and you understand both John Adams and John Quincy Adams' really useful critique of the danger of factions, the danger of oligarchies, the danger of the cult of celebrity, we begin to get a more nuanced perspective. And this is something that crosses party lines. It's not just one party that has this problem. We can see it right now. The Democratic Party is kind of has its range of candidates, and they're all promoting themselves on their personalities. And this is the way the news media covers them. And they pretend that they give you insights into the real person behind the name, and in fact, they don't. And that's even more dangerous in the age of television than it was in the past. But it has its roots in the old world, and this is where the past haunts the future.
We didn't have to look very far to find the cult of celebrity, the cult of personality, as a predominant feature in the writings of John and John Quincy Adams, especially the father. He went toe-to-toe with Benjamin Franklin in Paris during the time when they were negotiating the Treaty of Paris in 1783 that granted America its independence from Great Britain. And he saw Franklin as someone whose powerful persona outweighed his actual ability as a diplomat. And so from the get-go, even before the Washington cult, George Washington cult began, and the Adamses both very much respected George Washington, but they saw the cult and how it developed, and they saw how the fictions created an environment in which a Donald Trump, a cult celebrity president could become possible, because Americans feel... have always felt, and Jefferson is probably responsible for American exceptionalism taking root, but this whole idea of America being the greatest democracy that's ever existed, promoting ideal and rhetorical constructions over facing our actual problems, that we do have a tendency in this country toward adulation of single heroic figures. It's not a coincidence that it's the military that gave us George Washington, Andrew Jackson, Zachary Taylor, Ulysses S. Grant, Theodore Roosevelt, Dwight D. Eisenhower. There's something about the hierarchy, the system of subordination, that we have a quasi-king in our president. And so we need to feel the fantasy of being connected, having contact with that person. And so when you have them out on the campaign trail, that it magnifies the importance of personality. The cult of personality is just, I mean, the television age, the internet age, is only doubling down on what's always existed and what the Adamses saw as a distinctive worry, that we have a democracy, we have a republic, but here are the potential problems embedded in it, and we have to be wary of them.
The thing that we both love about them is that they actually believed in a real form of democracy, which was the town meeting where everyone could participate and be schooled in democracy. And John Quincy Adams believed in the right of petition. Even the right of petition should not only be granted to women to influence representatives, but even slaves should have the right of petition.
The book is The Problem of Democracy, The President's Adams Confront the Cult of Personality, and the authors are Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, a choreographer and filmmaker collaborate on the Titicut Follies, but first, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Day 72 of the North Dakota Legislature.
We're in the final countdown toward the end of the session.
House Speaker Larry Clemene told his House colleagues this could be a busy and stressful week with frustration and fatigue, so he urged the members to maintain a respectful tone when they deal with others in the chamber.
When we started this session, I said, let's rock and roll. Well, lately we've been doing a waltz or dancing in three-quarter time, but now I think it is time to rock and roll. So go out there and get them.
Legislative leaders are hoping to be done by the end of the week to keep at least 3 days in reserve if they need to come back into session later. Fees for such things as birth or death certificates could be rising. Under the Health Department's budget bill, which passed the House, the fees for those records are now $5. The bill, as amended by a House Senate Conference Committee, would allow the department to raise those fees up to $15. And the fees for each additional copy of requested records, which are now $2, can now go up to $10. Minot Republican Representative Dan Ruby asked the conference committee to take another look at those fees.
It seems odd that we just had a doubling of driver's license fee and this body wouldn't override a veto.
But the conference committee report was approved, and the House voted 70-22 to pass the bill. It'll now be considered in the Senate. And a group has submitted a petition to recall the mayor of Tower City. The petition committee leaves Scott Salberg and says not performing his duties, allowing the harassment of city officials at public meetings. Former city council member Randy Crisp is a member of the committee.
I've witnessed several times where one council member will start yelling at another council member for whatever reason with no respect for that person. I don't care what you got to say. Let the person say it. Have respect for them. Treat them like a human being. Just don't let another one yell at them because it's different from their opinion.
But Tower City member Stacey Lilja says everyone needs to stand up and take a step back to look at the facts.
I support Scott Salberg as our mayor. I think he's done a great job. And I don't know where recall petition committee, where their proof is. If they can provide solid evidence of what's going on, I would sure like to see that.
Mayor Salberg also refutes those claims. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Frederick Wiseman. He's a documentary filmmaker and the 2017 Academy Award winner for Lifetime Achievement in Documentary Filmmaking. He joins us by phone. Frederick, thanks for being with us today.
No, thank you for interviewing me.
And also by phone, James Sewell. He's the artistic director for the James Sewell Ballet. And the reason we're talking to James and Frederick is because they've collaborated on a ballet that's based on Frederick Wiseman's documentary. James, thank you for being with us today.
Delighted to be here.
Let's begin with the documentary because that's the seminal work here, Frederick. This goes back to 1967. It's The Titty Cut Follies. How did it come to be your first documentary?
Well, I had been teaching law and I didn't like that. And I wanted to make documentaries and I knew Bridgewater, the prison where the film was made, because I'd taken students there on field trips. So I thought that'd be a good subject for a documentary. And I knew the superintendent, and he agreed. And then it took us a year and a half to get permission from other people. But that's how it started.
This Titty Cut Follies was filmed inside the Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Bridgewater. It's a prison hospital for the criminally insane. And
right.
As I was reading this and this date, it occurred to me, had you read Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest before this? Or was there any kind
no.
of reference
no,
material?
No, it had. In fact, it was the other way around. When Kesey made the movie, he showed Titty Cut Follies to the cast and crew several times.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very intriguing because why did Bridgewater come into your line of sight? I mean, there was proximity, but why did you want to go inside this mental hospital?
Because I knew the superintendent, I thought that might help in my getting permission, and it did. It just seemed to me a good subject for a documentary because it was at a time when the technology had just been discovered that made it possible to make a film on any subject because you could shoot synchronous sound with a camera and a tape recorder. Somebody figured out how to do that. And my interest in making documentaries was to explore the real world because I thought, you know, there's enough comedy, tragedy, sadness in ordinary experience that if you hung around long enough, you could find enough material out of which you could cut a dramatic narrative movie.
And where does the title come from, Titty Cut Follies?
The title comes from an annual inmate staff variety show called The Titty Cut Follies. Bridgewater, the prison, was... Titty Cut is an old Indian name for the area where the prison was located, and the prison was on Titty Cut Street. And they had an annual variety show, which included the guards and the nurses and the people who worked at the hospital, at the prison hospital, with the inmates. And that annual variety show was called Titty Cut Follies. and the film is organized around sequences from the actual show of City Cut Follies, interspersed with events that took place among the inmates and guards in the daily life of the prison.
Frederick Wiseman is the documentary filmmaker who created City Cut Follies 50-some years ago. And James Sewell is the artistic director for the James Sewell Ballet. And this is a collaboration. There is a ballet that you created, James, around the City Cut Follies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which was definitely a different kind of process for me, and one that, you know, I have to thank Fred for. I got a call out of the blue from Frederick. And as a matter of fact, there were two films of his that he mentioned that he thought might be interesting. One was called Boxing Jim, and one was City Cut Follies of his. And he talked to me about these, and I had not seen the movies, and so he sent me, you know, a copy. And when I saw the City Cut Follies, I had never seen anything like it. There isn't anything else quite like it, and was really kind of in awe and thinking to myself that I had absolutely no idea how to make a ballet out of that. It was so foreign to the, you know, subjects that ballet was normally done with. So I, of course, said yes right away. Because I knew that at that time, I did not know how to solve the problems, the creative problems of that. And I knew I would have to grow as an artist in order to complete the piece. And it's been an extraordinary journey.
Well, people in Fargo-Moorhead are going to have a unique opportunity here, because the Titty Cut Follies film will be shown at the Fargo Theater at 7:30 on Friday evening. It's free and open to the public, but you have to be 17 or older. This is some pretty grim stuff in some cases. And Frederick Wiseman will be there for a question and answer period after the film. And then the next day, on Saturday at 7:30 at the Hanson Theater in the Dale Center for the Arts, the Titty Cut Follies, the ballet, is put on stage. And there are a range of ticket prices for that. So this is a very special opportunity for us. But let's get back to this film and ballet, because the film, Frederick, shows things that, quite frankly, in 1967 they're still disturbing to see. These are difficult images to process. This is a gritty with a capital G.
Yeah, well, it's life in a prison for criminally insane, it was pretty harsh. And Bridgewater, at the time, was thought to be one of the better prisons for the criminally insane. If you visited the prison for the criminally insane in Mississippi at the same time, Bridgewater would look like the Ritz Hotel, as bad as it was. Not the Ritz Hotel, but Bridgewater. I still remember vividly my first trip to Bridgewater, which had nothing to do with the film, when I took students there, because I couldn't believe that the state of Massachusetts or any state or any aspect of government would keep people in the conditions that I observed there.
Well, it is eye-opening, to say the least. And this raises the question of, well, the film was literally banned for 24 years by the state of Massachusetts.
Right.
And subsequently, it's been out in, I guess, in the public viewing for some almost 30 years now. So at any rate, it's available. But how do you make this into a ballet, James? Are there elements of movement that cues you take from the documentary that are imprinted in the ballet?
Very much so. And I really tried to be faithful in not every way, but in many ways as possible. You know, certain scenes lent themselves well to a dance, and I could see immediately there were a few that, oh, okay, well, these people are kind of moving in a way. And the thing that Fred first spoke to me about was that one of his inspirations was the strange gestures and tics and the ways that the inmates behave is unusual. And he thought that those could be interesting fodder to create movement from. And indeed it was. And using those gestures to drive them into the dance was a really interesting thing to try to figure out how to take, you know, an authentic gesture and then expand it in ways to capture the essence of it, you know, and to make dances. And that was, to me, was something I had done a bit, but not to this degree, and not in trying to create a whole world around it.
Frederick, what guidelines did you work by when you were filming the documentary 50-some years ago?
Just whatever interested me, whatever that was going on that interested me. It was my first film, and and I followed the same procedure ever since. During the shooting, I didn't have any thesis to begin with for Titicat Falls. I just accumulate material and figure out the point of view of the film in the editing much later. For example, for Titicat, I had about 100 hours of rushes, and it took me about 8 months to edit it. But I discovered the film in the editing. Mm. The idea in the shooting is just to shoot whatever looks interesting at the time and don't think too much about it and figure it out later.
Well, what I was getting at was the dilemma that sometimes is posed as questions to documentarians, and that is that what if you see something that makes you want to intervene?
Well, I followed the same pattern that I followed ever since. I just follow my instinct. If something looks interesting, you shoot it. And the worst thing you can do is try and stop and start within a sequence. So once I decided something had to be shot, you follow through all the way. It's a combination of good judgment, instinct, and luck.
The movie was banned for disturbing elements and images. Do you get that sense when you watch the ballet?
The movie was really banned for political reasons, and the state of Massachusetts used the privacy argument as a way of banning the film. But the state of Massachusetts was a conflict of interest, really, because the state was responsible for the conditions, and they were using the privacy argument to prevent taxpayers from seeing what the conditions were like.
But back to James, that question: how do you present things that were disturbing to see?
Well, and you know, one of the scenes that sticks out, there's a scene where somebody is force fed. He's on a hunger strike and is force fed, and it's one of the more upsetting scenes to watch. And so, you know, for me, it was a challenge: how do we get the sense of the horror that is there in a way, the discomfort, the mistreatment in ways, and yet still make something beautiful and stylized, and how to turn it into something, and came up with the whole thing with these sort of way people are being manipulated and moved and by the guards and different people. It, to me, there's a kind of an abstract beauty to it, even though the subject it's exploring is rather gruesome. To me, it's that fine line between beauty and horror. It's really an amazing challenge as an artist to try to strike.
I asked Frederick about his approach to documentary filmmaking. What is your approach to choreographing a ballet? Is there a James Sewell style?
Yeah, it depends on the piece. Over the years, I've made, 80, 90 ballets. And it depends upon, sometimes it's the music that starts it. And I'm just inspired by music and I want to make something to that, and sometimes a story pops into mind, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there's a story that I start with, and I want to find music to fit that. You know, this had the container of this movie that was there to work in reference to, and then we were really fortunate to be able to get Lenny Pickett, who's the band leader for Saturday Night Live, the saxophone player, and he's just amazing, and he did the whole score for us. It just captured so perfectly the feeling of that place. And so then it was, trying to work between the image in the movie and the soundscape that, I was given there. It was really then just to work with the dancers. My thought wasn't to necessarily recreate every scene in the movie, but my hope was that people would go on the same kind of journey, that within the movie there are funny things. There's some funny parts in it, and there's some horrid parts in it, and there's, all kinds of stuff, and there's mundane, boring things that happen. The gamut of life is in there, and there's a journey. You kind of touch on all these parts of yourself as an observer. And my hope was that people watching the ballet would have a same kind of journey. That there would be things that would be funny. That there would be things that would be kind of you wouldn't want to look at it. That there would be things that we could kind of get the same spectrum of human emotion.
Frederick, you mentioned your first career was teaching law, and you became a documentary filmmaker. Was there some motivation to moving in that direction in the terms of trying to change the way things were, or is it simply to exhibit them as they are?
No. Well, the real goal is to try and make a dramatic narrative movie out of unstaged experience. I think when I made Chitty Good Follies, I was still a little bit naive in thinking that documentary film could help change something, but that's I lost that innocence in making the movie.
Well, that's an interesting observation because you've made many movies since. And as I mentioned, you got this Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement in Documentary Filmmaking. What was that like to...
Well, I had no objection to receiving the Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement. It was, you know, it was a thrill. I was extremely pleased that my work was recognized by the commercial part of the industry, which is most of the movie business, so that I was glad that my films were recognized, and you know, it was a great moment for me.
We should also mention that Tom Brandau, who's an MSU Moorhead film professor, is working behind the scenes on this visit, and there will be a master class with you, Frederick Wiseman, with a question and answer period at 1:30 in the afternoon on Thursday in the King Lecture Hall on the campus of Minnesota State University Moorhead. Again, that's free and open to the public, so this is a wonderful opportunity. When you interact with film students, what are the most important ideas you want to get across to these people?
I try to illustrate how I try to think in film terms, so that how you can present complex ideas in pictures and sound. And so I try to pick illustrations from the movies that help them understand what I'm trying to do. Because the structure of the movie is something I worked very hard on. That's something that's rarely commented on, how you take disparate, unrelated events and organize them in such a way that there is a dramatic structure. And I try to talk about my effort to do that.
I was doing a little research about both of you here preparing for this interview, and James, you were a member of the American Ballet Theater, and Frederick, you created a documentary about the American Ballet Theater, but did you just miss each other?
Yes. I made the movie after James had was no longer with the company, I met James because Jennifer Holmans, who's the director of the Center for Ballet and the Arts at NYU, and the author of a great book about ballet called Apollo's Angels, told me about James's work, and she thought that he would be a good person to choreograph for the movie. And as a result of Jennifer's recommendation, that I got in touch with James.
Well, James, you mentioned the composer Lenny Pickett. What comes first here, the music, the dance? How do you create this whole?
You know, I think it started out, first of all, identifying the scenes, you know, that we thought might work for it. And then Lenny, he listened very closely. There is music in the film, so there's because of this folly. So they have amateur, you know, musicians there, and so there's a kind of a little rough sound to it a bit. And he tried to kind of work and get not very good instruments to record it on, and he tried to really capture a lot of the sound that was there. And what did we do? I would say, hey, you can do this dance. I need this kind of a feeling. And he would send me a little sketch. He would do like, a minute or two or something. It's kind of repetitious just to say, hey, does this feel right? Is this the right tone? And then I would say yes or no, or it could be a little bit more like this. And he'd send me notes. We would go back and forth a bit and then finally find the structure for it. And it was a wonderful process with him. He's amazing.
How long did it take to complete the choreography and rehearse the ballet for performance?
You know, from the time I got the call from Fred till we put it on the stage in New York was around 2 years.
Fred, what were you doing while James was choreographing the ballet? What did you have a role in sort of interacting in the process?
Well, when he was working on the choreography, I came out. I was out here for 8 or 9 weeks, but the pretentious way of describing it is dramaturge. the actual way of describing it is kibitzer. James's choreography,
He asked me what I thought about one thing or another, and I told him what I thought. And he either used it or he didn't use it, as he saw fit.
And I would always try to use Fred's thoughts because, you know, to me, he was the barometer. If it hits his gut right, it's like, well, this captures an essence that when he was there experiencing it, if I can tap into something that rings true, that was my gold standard. I needed to get to that before I could move on or before the dance. And some of the dances were really hard to find. There was one, there's a little bit of it's a scene that's not actually in the movie. It's more addressing the underpinning of what the you can feel the kind of anger and the stuff. And you know, some of these people did the worst things you can think of and things we can't even think of or shouldn't, mm-hmm. you know, in order to get in there. And you don't see that on the surface. You see these people and they're drugged out on Thorazine and you don't really know, but you know there's this tempest inside or has been. So one of the dances is really trying to explore that inner world of sort of unbridled rage or bridled or how that can do. And that dance, it was really hard to zero in on. And it, along with a couple other dances, I threw out two or three times and remade. And one of the times before we went to New York, I threw it out 2 days or 2 days before we left for New York. I recorded off it again. And because it wasn't feeling right. And Fred, you know, it wasn't clicking. And I agreed with them. And so that's what you do at the last minute.
And that was a couple of years ago. And, of course, now you've been taking this around the country a bit, and you're bringing it to Fargo-Moorhead. How challenging is it for your dancers?
It is, you know, it's as challenging to inhabit this world. It's emotionally exhausting, you know, to have to work. And you really have to it's not just doing steps. You have to be able to go into the mindset. You have to be able to inhabit these characters in ways that is, it's emotionally exhausting, you know, and they really, and it takes a lot of courage to do that, and to portray something really ugly on stage, to portray something, you know, that you know people are judging and stuff, and just to fully go there, you know, it takes courageous artists, and I'm so grateful to have such amazing dancers to be engaging. It's almost a whole new cast from New York, so we've dove in, and then some of the cast has been, I've had to re-sculpt some of the dances, and I'm going into different parts than I did in New York, and so that's fun for me, giving me a fresh take on the piece.
Well, James Sewell is the artistic director for the James Sewell Ballet. Frederick Wiseman is the documentary filmmaker behind the Titicut Follies. Again, you can see that movie at the Fargo Theater on Friday at 7:30. The ballet is Saturday at 7:30 in the Dill Center for the Arts at the campus of MSU Moorhead. And there's a master class Thursday afternoon at 1:30 on the MSUM campus at the King Lecture Hall. That is free and open to the public. The ballet does have ticket prices. Thank you both for joining me today. Frederick Wiseman, thanks for being with us. And James Sewell, thank you.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by NODAC Insurance Company, with over 70 agents throughout North Dakota ready to answer your insurance questions. NODAC Insurance Company has agents with answers. Online at nodacins.com.
The desire to put people into categories is universal. Cat people versus dog people, Leos versus Libras, Gryffindor versus Slytherin.
And why did you think she was a Slytherin?
Because my sister is actually a Slytherin, and she kind of has the same personality as my sister.
How we think about our personalities and those of other people, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 22nd. Few places in North Dakota capture the Old West like the town of Marmoth, a former railroad boomtown in southwestern North Dakota, about a half an hour from Bowman. In some ways, it has the same charm of Medora, another village on the Little Missouri River in the Badlands, but Marmoth isn't a tourist town. One of Marmoth's early buildings still stands, the Mystic Theater, which opened on this date in 1914. 7 years after the town was founded. It was a project of professional baseball player Guy Johnson. He built and managed the theater, which was one of the first houses built specifically for film showings. It seated about 200 people. Nightly shows were 10 to 15 cents, a nickel more on feature nights. The theater added sound equipment for talkies in 1930, but times began to get tough for the theater. Its name changed to The Palace and then The Marmoth. But as the town continued to shrink, and with more services available in the neighboring towns of Bowman and Baker, the theater closed in the 1950s. As an American bicentennial project, the Marmoth Historical Society began a restoration of the Mystic. A vaudeville show, put on by local residents, marked the theater's grand reopening on this date in 1976. Tickets were sold across the Dakotas, Montana, and Minnesota. The performers didn't use microphones, relying instead on the theater's acoustics. The next year, the Mystic Theater was accepted onto the National Register of Historic Places. The Marmoth Historical Society holds the deed. The Mystic stands across the street from the old Barber Auditorium on Marmoth's Main Street, near the gourmet Pastime Steakhouse. The theater still hosts occasional events, such as cowboy poetry gatherings, and it has seen additional renovations in recent years. As for the one-time pro ball player Guy Johnson, he didn't live to see the rebirth of his theater, passing away in 1971, 5 years before the grand reopening. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, should a controversial citizenship question be added to the 2020 census?
The Constitution says our family is everybody who lives here. Not everybody who's a citizen, everybody who lives here.
And where were you when a Nirvana song became a generation's anthem?
We were being slimed on by shirtless guys, like just moshing.
Hear news and stories you'll talk about all day on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, renowned Egyptologist and Minot native Mark Lehner will make appearances in his hometown next week, visiting schools and speaking at Minot State University. He joins us on Tuesday to discuss a fascinating career that began with a trip to Cairo in 1973 and led to a leadership role in the study of ancient Egypt. I hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.